and welcome to the All Japan Women's Destiny podcast. I'm your host, JD. Welcome to another episode as we go through the history of All Japan Women's Professional Wrestling through the classics episodes that you can find on various places of the internet. I vastly encourage to follow along and learn and enjoy the history of this just awesome women's wrestling promotion of the past. This is a spin-off in conjunction with the Red Leaf Retrocast. That is the proper episode where these come from. We hope you enjoy our audio and our discussions over the various wrestlers and the matches in which you go through the ages. If you like what you hear and you want more content, please consider checking out the Patreon. That is patreon.com/redleafretrocast, all one word, where we also cover LLPW, various other women's wrestling promotions of the past, and the project that the whole reason it exists is the Joshi 2010s journey, where we go through coming out of the dark ages of Joshi professional wrestling and really learning and having fun with wrestlers that we're very familiar with to this day to ones that we may have missed out on. I hope you enjoy the audio you're about to hear covering AJW. And if you want more, please, again, consider signing up to the Patreon and leaving us reviews over at iTunes, Spotify, and the like, all your favorite podcasting outlets in which you listen to AJW and the Red Leaf Retrocast. Enjoy. And it is episode 78, All Japan Women Destiny Time. And this is Legacy of Queens from the Nippon Budokan, August 25th, 1993. Look, guys, last episode, we finished, finally, the Japan Grand Prix of 1993, which saw Akira Hokuto defeat Yumiko Hota in the finals. Not the match you were expecting, but definitely a match you should check out from the entire Grand Prix is Akira Hokuto and Nami Toyota in the semifinals. One of the best matches you will find. On this episode, yes, we are doing Legacy of Queens, and it's going to be a two-parter. This first part is us kind of checking or catching up on the classics. We're kind of trying to stay in order as best we can, but we're going to probably find out real quick here that the classics don't exactly follow what we should cover and what we probably can find and have access to now. All Japan Women has taken off into the mainstream in 1993 yet again, but in a completely different way, as in the fact it's mostly the wrestling fans that have now taken notice, as opposed to the 80s. Yes, it was still mainstream in the sense of the word, but clearly we've been over this many, many podcast episodes now. The audience has completely changed from the teenagers and the teenage girls and the women audience to a wrestling audience, which is predominantly male, but a wrestling audience nonetheless. So this is one of the biggest shows of the year from 1993 and a good example of All Japan Women's consistent growth since coming out of the retirements of their most popular stars of the 80s. And Bull Nakano slowing down as well, but clearly the mandatory retirement rule is no longer a thing because Bull Nakano, despite taking a step back, is still on these cards and she's still plugging away. And Legacy of Queens is no exception to Bull Nakano still being one of the best, one of the most, we'll put it in quotes, pushed, because she certainly isn't a pushed star, but she's still heavily protected. Think of kind of escalating up and down the card in modern times, but instead she's just gonna be at the bottom, but yet when something super important rolls around, you bet your ass she's gonna be at the top. So if we look ahead for a second here before we go into Legacy of Queens, what the show drew, and all those nice little things we like talking about. We're looking towards a few other big shows, namely Marine Pead, which takes place in October, and Queendom, which takes place, I believe it's going to happen in March of 94. But there's also going to be two other shows for the remainder of 1993 we must mention. And one is in late September, which the classics are not covering, is the AJW-LLPW Total Opposition War Show, which takes place in Nagoya. Very important show there. And we're going to see some fallout from this show on how it affects those shows going forward. And then there's a big tag league tour, and AJW in the 90s right now, especially 93, the tour's got to go on for like 50 million days. It's just incredible. But no, they have Wrestle Queendom November 28th. That is the day. And then it's Saint Battle. That's what I was thinking of. Saint Battle. Saint Battle Final takes place in December of 93. What the classics will get to is a certain show that takes place in Yokohama. That's in March of 94. We got to look out for these shows. What they're drawing, what the impact is, who is on these cards, and who's going over. That's what's important. And if you're listening to and following along on the Patreon, patreon.com/redleafretrocast, to the LLPW reviews, this is the time when LLPW has really cemented themselves into the scene as something more than just like a monthly produce show. They are now a respected bunch, more or less, into the Joshi scene, and there are certain, we'll call them stars, that are building up their own credibility among the fan base and among the scene. And LLPW themselves want the crossover appeal with AJW. They are the top group. They have the wrestling fan base. And LLPW is definitely selling out Corrigan Hall, but they can't get out of Corrigan Hall. Again, LLPW reviews. We've actually gone through all of the start in 92. We've completed 1993, and we've started 1994. So AJW has quickly caught up. And a couple of those crossover shows were covered on LLPW reviews over on the Patreon. Legacy of Queens. Okay. We head on over to the September 6th, 1993 Wrestling Observer newsletter, which these are very useful now. Because before, in the 80s, not really covered. It was more for women. Very hard to find translation articles. Again, you're a longtime listener of this podcast. You know the struggle of just even trying to find the videos outside of the classics of the 80s. Things pop up every now and again. We get to do it. But now, with its newfound popularity in the 90s and the rising of stars such as Akira Hokuto, Bull Nakano took him into the next era, the passing of the torch to Aja Kong, along with really a boom period in the early 90s with New Japan and All Japan Pro Wrestling. Wrestling's doing very well now in Japan, even to the extent that LLPW can just go to Corrigan Hall on same-day shows, of which the Tokyo Dome are running, or certain city halls down the road, LLPW can get allegedly 2,000 plus people into the arena, and those shows do look full. So whatever the true number is, they're full nonetheless. And the Observer is covering a lot of things, whether it's television ratings in Japan, because they do have TV deals, maybe not as ideal in the 80s, but they're TV deals nonetheless. And All Japan women are running more often these Budokan hall shows and the like. So as soon as you start running bigger arenas outside Korakuen, more people start paying attention to you, and that's how you're truly breaking in. So, from The Observer, September 6, 93, despite having a 5 p.m. starting time on a Wednesday night, the All Japan Women's Budokan Legacy of Queens show drew an announced 14,500 fans 2,000 shy of a sellout. The show headlined by Aja Kong, the 3WA champion, defending the title against the JWP champion, Dynamite Kansai. This was the third largest recorded crowd in the history for a women's pro wrestling show. Certainly the second largest gate ever, trailing only a 1941 match in Louisville, Kentucky, featuring Mildred Burke and Elvira Snodgrass. Excellent last name. Love that. That drew 18,000. And the Dream Slam 1 show from earlier this year, April 2nd, 1993, at the Yokohama Arena, drew 16,500 fans. And in some ways, this crowd, and I do agree with this assessment that I'm just about to read from The Observer, because I was thinking something very much along these lines. So the quote continues. In some ways, this crowd was more impressive than Dream Slam 1 for a number of reasons. First, Dream Slam 1 was the first show filled with interpromotional matches. Not exactly true, but yeah, the first big interpromotional show. The first show with a gimmick such as that should draw better than subsequent shows. Factual. In addition, Dream Slam 1 featured the return to the ring of Chigusa Nagayo. Did not work on this card at Legacy of Queens. The early starting time of a weekday couldn't have helped either. So that's where if you listen to, Bradley Frederick has proper, or here on All Japan Women, especially when talking about Stardom and the like, it's very important when you're evaluating attendances to realize what day of the week it is, what kind of show it is, what time it is. If it's a primetime night, Saturday night show, you should expect higher numbers more or less than what you got compared to, say, a Monday morning or Monday late afternoon kind of deal. You get the idea, though. I continue back to the quote. As far as a gate, it almost surely only trailed Dream Slam 1 and may have been the second million-dollar house in the history of women's wrestling. Now, was not able to exactly confirm if this Legacy of Queens show was a million-dollar gate. I found one source that said it did, one source that said it got to about 950,000. So I'd like to preface that the source did not include the merchandise / program sales. I don't think that would be enough to crack the million, but even if we're going push comes to shove and comp tickets, I believe, based on the information I have, that we're damn close to a million with this show, Legacy of Queens, which is quite the accomplishment, regardless of the number cracking that or not. I mean, just recently, in the broader sense, AEW Grand Slam on television was one of the few television million-dollar gates in history. So that shows just how tough it is to even cross that number. But even I would say approaching that number is remarkable in and of itself. Let alone a women's promotion doing this, whether it's the stigma of women's sports, stigma of women's wrestling, stigma of the culture around women's wrestling. There's a lot of factors to consider there. Let's see. Later in The Observer, he starts going on and on about the various matches. But I want to take this on over to the September 27th 1993 Observer, where there's a good, since the next show we're going to cover is probably going to be something in September, this is important to know. Just some notes from this. All Japan announced its tag team tournament starting on October 10th, so we're still, you know, a month away from this. Regardless, the teams are Akira Hokuto, Manami Toyota teaming up. Pay attention to that name, Akira Hokuto, because I'll have more on her in a sec. Aja Kong and Saki Hasegawa are a team. That should be super interesting. Hopefully, Saki Hasegawa doesn't eat every single pin imaginable and they lose. Mita and Shimoda, LCO, teaming up. Suzuka Minami is teaming with Bat Yoshinaga. Now, Bat Yoshinaga, if we go on over to her cage match here, because I wanted to bring her up as well. I've mentioned the last couple podcast episodes here on All Japan Women Destiny, If you're listening on that feed, thank you. If you're listening on Red Leaf or Retrocast proper, also good. But Bat Yoshinaga, we've mentioned a few times in these recent episodes because her career is coming to an end soon. A few podcasts ago, it was revealed that she's had severe neck issues and she's dealing through injuries. And let's face it, she isn't very... So, Bat Yoshinaga, her last match, effectively, is the AJW title tournament, which takes place in mid-September. She will not be in this tag tournament, as far as I'm aware. She does try to make a brief comeback later, but... And I haven't looked at the exact tag league as of yet, and I kind of want to do this in a fun little mysterious way so I don't know literally everything going in. So who becomes Suzuki Minami's partner is going to be a fun thing to find out. Yumika Hota and Takako Inoue are a team. Toshi Yamada and Kyoko Inoue are a team. So it's interesting that Toyota is not teaming with Yamada and Kyoko isn't with Hokuto, so they're keeping things fresh. The LLPW team coming in is Eagle Sawai and Yasha Kuranai. So not Harley Saito and not Mickey Honda. That's why I wanted to bring them up. And Kairi Ito and Tomoko Watanabe are the team that's probably going to get last place. Then they announced a bunch of opening matches. It is important to note that Reggie Bennett will be coming in for a couple dates to AJW. I bring her up specifically because she becomes quite the figure going forward in AJW, and this is kind of her first taste. The real first taste we saw of her, at least in terms of this podcast, was actually on the LLPW reviews when the LLPW wrestlers went over to Minnesota and Reggie Bennett was one of the big babyface stars. It was announced October 9th at Tokyo Bay NK Hall, which is the Wrestle Marine Pre-Ad show. Bennett will team with Bull Nakano, taking on Suzuki Minami and Yumika Hota. And expect Medusa to do occasional one-week tours with AJW soon. So we're getting the Gaijins in. Then they announced a couple tournaments. They announced the last champion for the Japanese women title was Debbie Malenko. She will not return to this promotion after breaking her leg in March. Although the latest word is that Malenko and Terry Power, who are both regulars in the group and suffered serious injuries, will return around January, is what is being reported. Don't hold your breath on Debbie Malenko. Little television show news. Here you go. All Japan Women's Television Show covered last week, so this would be the week prior to September 27th, 93, showed the main event of this Legacy of Queens show, Aja Kong versus Dynamite Kansai, drew a 6.8 rating, which shows that when taken out of the late night time slot, the group still maintains one hell of a lot of mainstream appeal. Now, that 6.8 rating is very good at the time. They were not in their usual like midnight 1 a.m. time slot where they get like ones or less. It's definitely something to be said that if you put AJW on TV, they can draw for the big important things, which is why something like this was thrown in there. And probably the one of the most interesting things is what I'm about to read here for the next few things. Akira Hokuto, who's been working with a broken bone in her back and blown out knee, has finally taken time off to undergo knee surgery, although she'll be back next week for the September 29th show. So, this is just how absurd these women worked through injuries. If you look at Akira Hokuto's match guide here, and you look at 1993, she blew out her knee, and she's been dealing with back injuries essentially all summer. It's pretty much just been found out there's a bone busted back there, and why she just continues the work, she takes no time off, and why she is considering retirement at the end of the year in 1993, which goes into a match or two that we're going to go into when we kind of go through these matches here. But if you look at this show, this show took place on August 25th, 1993. She blew out her knee on August 21st. She will continue to work these shows weekly all throughout the rest of August and throughout September up until September 5th, I believe. So if we're going by the Observer, she will be back in the next week in October, which would absolutely coincide with what I'm seeing here, where she comes back on August or October 7th against Suzuka Minami to set up for... She's basically coming back for the Wrestle Marine Pied main event against Aja Kong because she won the Japan Grand Prix. So if you want to look at a timeline, she takes like 4 weeks off, if we're being generous. It's pretty absurd how much this woman worked and why this is kind of known as her last great year. So from, I would say, the time when she returned after breaking her neck and her climbing up the card to this 93, she becomes an enigma in this scene. Now, we're going to find out in 94, 95, 96, and so on how often she works and what position she's in and how much of a star she maintains, so to say. We're going to judge some things on that, for sure. But she'll never reach this level of, I would say, fever pitch in-ring ever again because she just works so much. The quantity is so much there. It's much in the same realm of Bull Nakano from 89 to about 92. Very much in that thing. Now, they also say, people also say that Bull Nakano wound down after she dropped the title and she still worked 200 matches. Maybe we'll find out Akira Hokuto does exactly that. She gets the occasional main event, but she's still working 100 plus matches a year, which if we put in modern terms is still a lot. So that's what we're going off there. And then Bull Nakano announced for the October 25th LLPW show at Korakuen Hall. Again, go to the LLPW reviews, get to listen to more Bull Nakano beat some LLPW ass. And just some LOPW news that I had discovered right here. A 190-pound female powerlifter called Powerhouse Rayon will debut for LOPW shortly. Not true. We do not see this debut. So something either happens or it's something that was severely delayed. Because we're in 94 now. There is no Powerhouse Rayon to be seen. Great name, by the way. Powerhouse Rayon. All right. Legacy of Queens. The classics will not cover on this episode. The matches of Infernal Kaoru and Chaprita Asari taking on Bolshoi Kid of Candy Akatsu of JWP. Toshiyamada and Kari Ito taking on the FMW duo of Kudo and Nabeno. And the main event of Aja Kong and Dynamite Kansai. Not title versus title, but title of the 3WA kind. That is for the next episode. We'll be going into a lot of breakdown over that Aja Kong Kansai match because I have never seen it, and I really want to. So, we begin. Let's see if I can do this in order of when... Let's see. I'll just do it in the order that the classics have presented. So, Classics Episode 77 begins with the six-woman tag match of Tomoko Watanabe, Numachi and Chikako Shiratori taking on and defeating the team of Utaka Hozumi, Yasha Kurenai, and Mizuki Endo. This match went 15 minutes 42 seconds. It's unbelievably long, and I must talk about this arena setup and stage setup. It's very late 80s, early 1990s WCW-esque, but still maintaining what we've known from AJW now, from a few of their big shows. They're definitely evolving with the times in presentation, I would say. They're still not, they're still definitely way more extravagant than, say, the black tights of New Japan. I mean, nobody's out here dressing like Jushin Thunder Liger, unless you want to count Akira Hokuto's entrance. However, there's definitely a lot more feeling of individuality in AJW if you're comparing to UWF, New Japan, and All Japan Pro Wrestling. All Japan Pro Wrestling does have, you know, Kawada with the yellow tights, Masao with the green, those types of things. But for things like gear and unique stage presentation, they're taking that aspect and element kind of from WCW, is my take. And reading interviews from various people like Kyoko Inoue and Manami Toyota, they watched a lot of early WCW, and they liked things such as the move innovation and the ability and want to try to new things. And so I'm really wondering now if they had input to, hey, let's make this stage something special. Because we saw it at Marine Piad with Aja Kong Boldacano on that day. And this one really looks like the wrestlers are exiting a castle. You know, it looks like a theater, you know, 2D castle cardboard set, but they're entering and exiting through these castle doors and walls, and it's got good blue lights. It looks like a queen entering her kingdom, which is the ring. And I have to believe that's on purpose, so to say. As for the gear. So, Hozumi has her little goofy flower fan, or feather fan. Yashikura and I with her wooden sword stick and her delinquent look that she's got going on, you know, the parachute pants and whatnot. Mizuki Ando, onesie, big geek there. Talk about her a lot on LLPW. But when the AJW crew come out, this trio is something to behold with your eyes. Tomoko Watanabe looks like an actual wrestler. She's going to go out there and do some mat wrestling, know what I mean? And then we got Chikako Shiratori coming out in a nice little Sunday dress with a fancy Sunday hat. And looks like, honestly, it looked like all six of these people were going to spend their time at the beach in their own way. Endo and Watanabe, they're going in the ocean. And they're going to go swimming. Hozumi with the fan, Shiratori, they're going to go out shopping to all the little stores that are near the beach. And then Kurenai is going to bully Numachi, who's in, I guess she's going to dig holes in the sand and wears her goofy little helmet for protection. Numachi, the gardener, she got to go. She is full geek. I don't know. She is such a standout on this roster and what they're presenting because of what a goof she looks and acts. I mean, she's poking Yashikura and I with the plastic shovel, and it is a plastic shovel. Just like what you would like dig a hole at the beach with. It is that ridiculous. I did laugh in the match with Watanabe taking the plastic little helmet, putting it on her head and doing headbutts. That made me laugh. That got a kick out of me. The match was a lot of Yashikura and I doing choke slams to, I believe it was Shiratori, but the my takeaway is Chikako Shiratori is developing pretty quick. And she's really coming across the screen and popping out. And that's probably why she's getting bigger and bigger looks to her. And the gear's getting more individualistic. Tomoko Watanabe, she started on that. And don't get me wrong. In the ring, she's really standing out more and more, doing flip moonsault presses off the top. I mean, they're doing electric chairs. These wrestlers up and down the card are trying a lot of new things to develop their skills, and I really appreciate that. Very interesting match, just from kind of an undercard perspective and who's being presented and how. So, again, the takeaway, let's keep an eye on Chikako Shiratori going forward. The next match was a banger of a match. It was the AJW team of Yumiko Hota, Manami Toyota, and Saki Hasegawa taking on the JWP trio of Mayumi Ozaki, Plum Mariko, and Hikari Fukuoka. Actually, a lot of these matches had nicknames to them. let me see if I can't pull that up. I have them written down. Let's see here. Let's see. Kurenai pinned Numachi with the golden arm bomber. That's the name of her chokeslam finisher. Let's see. That is what. Okay, is it the Deadly Clash? No, that's later in the show. this trio's match. There's the Mickey Honda elimination. Where am I looking here? There's just so many words together. here we go. High tension triple impact. Couldn't help but notice the LLPW wrestlers didn't get their fancy trio tag match name, but here we are. This trio's match with its wacky billing name, Triple Impact, it went 25 minutes, 9 seconds, and I would say a good chunk of the first 10 minutes is doing your average in and out tag match, get the heat kind of moves, and then they just go off. And it's a lot going on. Hikari Fukuoka is doing everything she can to do high presses and moonsaults. Ozaki's doing German suplexes. And there's Plum Mariko kind of taking a beating throughout the beginning stages of this. But the one who takes the beating the most is the last, like, 8 minutes. It's Hikari Fukuoka. And they really wanted to make sure that Hota, Toyota, and Hasegawa beat the shit out of this woman. There was a lot of instances where the tags were being late breaking up, so it was up to the wrestlers to kind of pull their own shoulder up, but that's neither here nor there. The point I want to make is Hikari Fukuoka, since her run in the Grand Prix, is just on a roll offensively, and her look keeps getting better, and she's clearly standing out more to the crowd and myself. So maybe that's me looking more into the crowd, maybe not, but she is certainly rising above the level that she's at in this kind of mid-card sense. Now, this is a match third from the top, to be fair. And Manami Toyota is also in this match. She and Fukuoka are kind of hand-in-hand right now. I think Toyota athletically is still a bit better, but I think a complete package, Hikari Fukuoka is right there with Manami Toyota as where they stand in their current companies, because Manami Toyota hasn't really won anything yet either. So they're pretty even when that comes. I guess we'll see if JWP pushes her first, or will AJW push Toyota first? There's your comparisons. Miami Ozaki, you know what? Miami Ozaki, when she came out of this match, she came out to a song. She came out to, because the songs are absurd that these people are coming to. It's they're hiding no copyright infringement here. It is Pretty Maids. It's the Red Hot and Heavy song. Let's see if I can play this right quick, because it's quite something. And if you fans know anything about Miami Ozaki, you got to look at this cover album of Red Hot and Heavy by the Pretty Maids, because it's a woman in black leather with a chain coming out of a box. It could not be more Miami Ozaki. So I got to remember that song and forever make it a Miami Ozaki drop going forward, because that's what we're going to do here. It's very good. Very good. But the match is awesome. Okay, there's a lot of just crazy pin sequences. I mentioned Fukuoka just taking an absolute beating in this match at the end, and it's true. Yumika Hota does a huge combination of no-selling, messing up moves and slipping, but she's not as fast as everybody else in this match, so she really stands out like a sore thumb. And I'm not saying she was bad in the match, but she certainly stunk a little bit. She stunk it up. So what would end up happening is she has five of these wrestlers all running around her until someone like came up to her, and then she'd do a big power move and stick them in the mat real hard. There was a few instances about the early to midway point in the match where you had people like Ozaki and Plum trying to drop kick Hota and do things, and she was not having it. Well, in comes Hikari Fukuoka for a front drop kick, and you could tell she just laid it in because Hota lost her balance and fell down. So it was very much egos getting in the way. And to be fair, at this time, with interpromotional warfare, AJW was no exception, along with that UWF and New Japan feud, or any other interpromotional feud for that matter, you got to have an ego, because the whole idea is to not get shown up by your competition, by your competitors, by your invaders. You guys are the baby faces, and for all intents and purposes, the AJW wrestlers are the baby faces on this show. And going forward, they are the top dogs. So under no circumstance are these wrestlers made to look weak. And I'm waiting on the LOPW reviews. When will this hurt the promotions? JWP and LOPW. What will happen? What are the compromises being done throughout shows like this? Well, after Hikari gets just stuck into the mat like 60 times, she finally hits like a German suplex on Saki Asagawa, so someone that AJW thinks is near her level. She can get pinned, and that's a victory for JWP. That's the idea behind it, and this is a... I would say it's, if we're in the context of 93, it's definitely a 3 out of 3 type match. It's very exciting. It's nonstop. There's a lot of energy to it. Get past the first kind of feeling out period, and you will not be disappointed. This match is phenomenal. It's a lot of fun, and it has a lot of people that I really enjoy watching, and the heat is fantastic throughout it all. And we get to the main event of Classics Episode 77. It's, I believe, fourth from the bottom on this particular show. Did it have a fancy Billy name? Let's see. 3, 4. No Billy name. I will call this Battle of Cute. It is if Tam Nakano and Mina Shirakawa had a blood feud. Because here we have Takako Inoue against Cutie Suzuki. Takako Inoue defeats Cutie Suzuki in 18 minutes, 17 seconds. I really enjoyed this match. I think it's just short of the Big Dave 4-star mark. He actually went 3.25 in the Observer. No Observer rating for the Trios match, so something was severely cut out there. Or he didn't see it on some Tade traping. But 3.25 seems pretty small to me, because this match had a weird, good, slow pace and heat to it. It really reminds me of a... I guess in-ring-wise, it would remind me more of a Yuka versus Tam Nakano match. Yuka Sakazaki, that is, against Tam Nakano, where they're into the ground, they're into kind of subtle hair pulling, angry faces, some forearm battles, and they're just really picking their moments to do a big move or two and really rope you in. Because a lot of this match was exactly that. It started out with a couple big slaps, test each other. The crowd goes, ooh, because there's these two beautiful women hitting each other real hard. They're in their Sunday's best gear coming out. Even Takako Inoue is coming out to fucking Pretty Woman. So they know exactly what they were doing, billing this match and setting it up. And Cutie Suzuki's a mainstream star. She's in TV shows, she's in movies, she's got a video game about her in Japan, so... But Takako Inoue is like twice her size. So they have to do something to suspend your disbelief that Cutie can kind of measure up to Takako, at least physically. And what that is a ground mat game with heavy grappling, and actually Takako Inoue really stretches her good. She's pulling her hair, like I said, she's twisting her ankles, She's stomping on ends of feet so you can't turn over right. And Cutie Suzuki is selling this very well. And then it builds up to a nice little hot finish where Cutie's hitting, you know, the Cutie specials, and Takako's hitting various suplexes of her own. You know, I think if you put this maybe 4 years ago, you know, in 1988, then this match would definitely have been much more well received. But in my case, I'm kind of into these to an extent. I have to obviously like the wrestlers first, and I do like Cutie Suzuki and Takako Inoue. But the finish is what really gets interesting. So they're stretching each other, they do their hot moves, and then it gets to the end. And the ending sequence reminded me of, just to stay relevant to modern times, how Yuka Sakazaki beat Miyu Watanabe at the end of the Princess Cup in TJPW here in 2022, where Cutie gets rocked with, I believe it's a Tiger driver or something or another. And she's finally out and done. So she's real slow to get up. And you see this twice in two matches. And Takako's kind of looming over her, waiting for her to get up. And Takako punches her in the face. And then it does it again a second time, but this time punches her in the like the temple and drops her hard. And Cutie's looking dazed and out of it. Her eyes are crossed. And she gets up one more time. And Takako comes off the rope for essentially a King Kong knee drop or a Jumbo Tsuruta-esque knee off the top and pins her 1-2-3. And I'm like, man, there's something about unique finishes like that in ending sequences that are just very engaging. I think they do bring the match down a little bit, at least from a, I don't know, a star rating scale, but on my recommended scale, I'm like, man, this is super interesting. It told a good story. I'm really into the wrestlers. And Takako came out. She was clearly the one to favor in the match. So, you know, if you want to go 3 out of 3 recommendation on this, I won't argue. I'm personally going 2 out of 3. I think it was missing that heavy excitement level to make it great. But definitely a must watch, I would say. It's a you wouldn't waste your time recommendation. And that'll move us on to Classics Episode 78. This elimination match, it is Team AJW against Team LLPW. And we saw another LLPW AJW elimination match over on the LLPW Journey, so, and it takes place after this one. And I was wondering, are they going to do something similar in this match on this AJW show as opposed to the LLPW show? And it played out kind of exactly what I was expecting. And it's not about the moves. The match goes for 14 minutes, 54 seconds. So it's not incredibly long. But what happens is Bull Nakano and company essentially bum rush this LLPW team. Leo Kitamura is eliminated like immediately. Okay. Well, I say immediately. It was like not at the 9 minute mark that three people just got eliminated right away because they just did this like weird walk and brawl and tag sequence to start off. But as soon as the match started getting over, Leo Kitamura is eliminated immediately. Miki Honda is eliminated right after her. And Yukari Osawa is eliminated right after her in three quick succession pins. So the LLPW team is immediately down 5-2. And what happens in the next minute is Eagle Sawai gets in this ring and runs roughshod over AJW. As in, she has two big clotheslines and like a small package, so she eliminates Suzuka Minami, Etsuko Mita, and Mima Shimoda. Eagle Sawai essentially eliminates all of LCO minus Akira Hokuto. Which, again, hey, another plug. If you've been listening to the LLPW shows over on the Patreon, you will know by now that LCO invaded LLPW in early 93, and they've been feuding, more or less, all year to get to this point. So Eagle Sawai eliminating all of these team members to get the team back to 2v2, that makes total sense to me. Now, about a couple minutes later, Bat Yoshinaga eliminates Harley Saito with a couple of her screw wheel kicks that she does, and Bat Yoshinaga, that's all she does. All she can do is saunter around the ring, try a wheel kick attempt, and just pray it hits something. And then people sell it, and there's misdirection spots. I hit my teammate accidentally spots with the wheel kick, and Bat eventually hits Harley Saito and pins her. So it's down to Eagle Sawai against Bat and Bull, all by her lonesome. She gets a couple decent near falls in, but ultimately she falls to a 2-on-1 situation. Bat wheel kicks her, does a really bad scoop slam, and Nakano, Eagle Sawai does kick out of the regular guillotine leg drop. There's no Fire Thunder Drive or anything going on, but she does kick out of that. She does not kick out of the double team into the flipping guillotine leg drop. Some may know it better as the Harlem Hangover, but Eagle Sawai loses. Go listen to the next, go listen to the LLPW show where it's the Eagle Sawai show on that one, the next crossover. Meltzer gave this match fucking 4.5. I didn't think it was that good, but it was definitely exciting. Okay? You know, I'm like on the low end of a 2 out of 3, 1 out of 3 situation. Good action, quick elimination, kind of come out of nowhere and keeps you on your feet. And then we get Kyoko Inoue against Shinobu Kandori. The build as the supreme master of wrestling match. Is it better? I think immediately a lot of people are going to compare this Kandori match to the Akira Hokuto match. And obviously, it's not going to be better than that. That's one of the greatest women's matches of all time. It has a legacy behind it. But is it, I guess, ring energy-wise, as good as that match? And Kyoko Inoue, she was on her A game here. She was certainly not holding back any of her moves from the swinging BT Bomber type situation, doing big swings. Kandori has a sense of credibility to her. It was definitely good. Like, I'm not huge on most Shinobu Kandori matches, but she does have an aura to her, and, you know, looking like female Antonio Inoki also doesn't hurt matters with her pompadour and big chin, but they kind of beat the shit out of each other for a good 17 minutes. And Kandori, being a grapple expert as she is, she didn't let Kyoko Inoue have her way, which tends to make quite a few Kyoko Inoue matches pretty boring, if I do say so myself. So that led to Kyoko Inoue doing a lot more speed, doing a lot more jumping off the top, and leading to Kandori to lock in some submission holds and the like. So this one was just solid. Big Dave Meltzer gave it 4 stars in the Observer. I'm not quite there. I'm about 2 out of 3. I would kind of put this on the same level as the Cutie Suzuki Takako Inoue match. Just this clearly had more star power of a different sense of the word and feel. Regardless of the matter, Kandori locking in essentially the Rings of Saturn, or the Brutalizer, however you want to put it, and in a way tapping out. Big victory for Shinobu Kandori, and we are going to learn more and more that Shinobu Kandori, she rules the world. I'm not saying she's Sid Vicious of Joshi, but she could be. Could be in time. She don't drop falls very often, that's for sure. Did drop that one to Akira Hokuto earlier in the year. Guess we'll keep that in the back of our heads. That brings us to the main event of Classics 78 here, where it's Akira Hokuto defending the All-Pacific title against Rumi Kazuma, another founder of LOPW, along with Shinobu Kandori. Big Dave gave this 4 stars flat. And I tend to agree with this one. I don't know how many times I got to come on this podcast and say Akira Hokuto is on another level. Now she has broken bones in her back, and she's got a blown out knee, and she's still the best women's wrestler in the world and a top wrestler in the world. Her look, her appeal, her entrance, the music, the ring game, she is the total package right now. No, she's not Lex Luger. She's way better. Okay, maybe tan-wise, she's on that level of Lex Luger. Regardless, this was something built up over the last couple months. It was built up from the mid-June LLPW crossover show with AJW, where Rumi Kazuma got a big pinfall victory in a main event on an LLPW show on LCO member, but she also really hurt her back in that match, Rumi Kazuma. She had a little bit of neck issues. She was real slow. And she's essentially taken a couple months off, more or less, to get to this match here. And she looked a lot better. But she does re-aggravate this injury in a couple matches here and there, which will contribute more to their eventual rematch, which takes place in LLPW as a hair versus hair match, which I didn't review not that long ago. I did review not that long ago. This match went 16 minutes. Wasn't any good. I would say the selling of Akira Hokuto really made this a match. Rumi Kazuma put on a big, serious face. She's got big, thick hair. Not very mobile. I'm not sure how much the injury played into how they paced the match, but I have to think that it played a little role, which kept it from going to a higher regard. But look, Rumi Kazuma was still doing cross bodies off the top to the floor. Akira Hokuto is still doing flipping sentons to the floor, Jushin Thunder Liger style. They're insane. Despite their injuries, they're still going out and having the exact match that they want to have. They're just working a little bit slower in certain times. But Kazuma made sure to really try to kick the blown-out knee of Akira Hokuto throughout this match. She was kicking the hamstring, not really the knee, so she was staying away from the actual hurt part, but they were able to sell it nonetheless. And Kazuma got some good near falls off of specifically her dragon suplex. That really got over with the crowd. And even Hokuto got a big near fall victory with the gut-wrench powerbomb that she's done to put away a lot of people, especially on her road to victory in the Grand Prix. I really appreciate the limb work both did, where Hokuto was trying to wrench the neck and aggravate the lower back of Kazuma, playing into her injury history. This is good. This is just good work all around from two pros. And if I want to make a modern comparison, I would point to that Tam Nakano All Cap Saki match in the recent, at this time of recording, 5-star Grand Prix, where Tam has been selling this elbow for weeks, and for All Cap Saki to blatantly ignore the obvious sell job of Tam Nakano's elbow, and then eventually when the person's ignoring it for so long, you have no need to really sell it. And that's a fault on the wrestler not realizing how to work the match. And hey, I've gone to some like wrestling class lessons and all that stuff, so there's definitely psychology to these things. You don't have to truly focus on it the entire time. But Rumi Kazuma made damn sure in this match, anytime she wanted to gain an advantage, it was go after the knee. Go after the knee. Maybe hit a suplex, go after the knee. You know, it's that advantageous psychology that it was quoted to me, or verbalized to me. Which, that's good. I like that stuff. I really do. Akira Hokuto drops Kazuma real hard. Real hard with a, what was it? I know she hits another, I think she hits a second gut wrench later in the match. And then she drops her with a, I think it's just a German. And again, this is much like that Cutie Suzuki against Takako situation where Rumi's dropped. She's got cross eyes on her. She's slow to get up. And she's kind of crawling towards Hokuto, who's kind of leaning over, looming. And Akira Hokuto drops her one more time. She's looming again. Just picks her up. Northern Lights bomb. 1-2-3. Title retained. All Pacific champion. Not the most memorable of title runs, but it is the All Pacific title at the time. And let's quickly go over this run Akira Hokuto had with this title. Because Bison Kimura lost it to Kyoko Inoue, who then Kyoko Inoue for a brief time, 170-ish days, had it with Akira, and then lost it to Akira Hokuto November 92, so she's had this most of the year, about 10 months? And what happens is post-match, Akira Hokuto vacates the title. And to my knowledge, between January of 93 to this point, 93, she did not have a single defense. And at the time, again, Joshi Women's Wrestling, even today, has a problem with treating these titles like they're boxing titles instead of wrestling titles. Wrestling titles, you need to defend, I think, more often to create prestige and honor behind it. While if they're presented as boxing titles, then I would say the title has an aura still and maybe a sense of prestige, but there's a lot missing for the audience to latch onto. And so, is this the last? I don't think this is the last time she holds this title. I don't think so. No, she's no, Hokuto ends up holding a different. Yeah, she doesn't. Yeah, she. I think maybe the tag at some point, but I think this is her last major singles title in All Japan. Because I don't. No, she doesn't win the red belt ever. That's what her legacy's for. I don't think she wins the white belt ever again, is what I'm going at. So she vacates this title, particularly due to injury, and she's thinking of retirement. And so she gets on the mic post-match, does all this, and calls out Shinobu Kandori. And the idea is they're building up to a rematch because of their big Dream Slam match that got a lot of buzz and story to it. Okay? Kandori comes out, essentially agrees to the match. They're going to build to it, and it's going to be on the books as a hair versus retirement match, or a hair retirement match. The person who loses is to shave their head and retire. Now, I can tell you on the LOPW journey, none of that happens. Does the rematch happen? Yes. But the stipulation behind these things, no one can agree to terms. Because Hokuto doesn't actually want to retire. She's contemplating it, and in 94, she spends a long time in Mexico, aka her first marriage. So she goes to CMLL and becomes a woman over there, if you know what I mean. So Rumi Kazuma, coming off this match, and she cuts a promo in the post. She becomes the rival, teaming up with the LCO feud in LOPW, and she will have the hair versus hair match against Hokuto. And due to the honor for LOPW, in comes Kandori to defend the company. And that's what we're building to, particularly in AJW for the rematch. In LOPW, it's the Kazuma-Hokuto match. So there's all your connections, and that's why I said pay attention to Hokuto, because a lot is going to happen to her particularly from this point forward throughout the year. She also, in between shows, we'll be doing here, between this and the Marine Piet show, is she refuses the red belt, because the story goes, the Matsunagas, the Booker men, wanted Akira Hokuto to beat Aja Kong. Because the star power of Hokuto and her mainstream appeal is at the highest for the company. So by that regards, it makes sense. However, Hokuto herself, with her injuries and with her past, this won't be the first time she'll do this, refuses the title and refuses the title match altogether. I personally believe that they should have just gone through with the title match and Aja Kong wins. That way she defends the title. But that's not the way it was done back then. They had different ideas and different traditions, and Hokuto's wish was granted. For the next episode, I will maybe be less talkative and less in-depth, but it will for sure be more along the line of focusing on the matches between the kind of luchadora match in the opener, for the next Classics episode, 79, the Yamada Ito against Kudo Nobeno match, and then the main title match, where it's Aja Kong defending against Kansai. That will be in our next episode. I guess that does it here.